A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Isn't the point of traveling to get away from it all? To feel the best you've ever felt? Then maybe you should check out Aruba. You'll spend your time relaxing on cool, white, sandy beaches and floating in healing blue water. You'll meet locals brimming with gratitude for an island that redefines what a paradise can be. When your trip comes to an end, you won't need another vacation because you just had the vacation. That's the Aruba effect. Plan your trip at aruba.com.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Before we get into the podcast, I'm going to say it. Discord link is in the channel, in the description. I have a Discord. It's pretty fun on there. There's a bunch of people talking about music, gigs, shows. I give away merch. I do all of that. Tickets, music, everything's on there. Also, if you do listen to this podcast and you haven't subscribed, please subscribe. It will mean the world. It makes the podcast get bigger, which means we can get bigger guests and more interesting conversations. So please subscribe. This week on the podcast, Destructo, aka Gary Richards. This guy has done everything in the world, from running record labels, being one of the biggest promoters in North America, releasing records. He is now in the head of AMF, which is All My Friends' promotion company. What he's done over the years is absolutely amazing. I don't want to go into too much detail because we go into that on the podcast. But the reason, there's a huge reason why electronic music is in North America, and Gary is one of those reasons. So I'm going to stop talking and let you guys listen. It's a very, very good podcast, this one. I really enjoyed it. Without further ado, Destructo. Mr. Gary Richards, how are you, man?
I'm good. It's good to see you. I know. You and the beard.
It's been a while. When was the last time I spoke to you? When was the last time I saw you?
I don't know. Was it on a ship somewhere?
It must have been. But I wasn't last on ship until 2018, 2019. Yeah,
it might have been the friendship of 2018.
No, I didn't.
I think your room was next to mine.
That wasn't even friendship then, dude.
Oh, that was before that?
That was before that. Yeah. I've never done friendship, I don't think.
Well, shit. I need to get you. I try to book you all the time, dude. You're in demand.
Sorry, man. We'll make it work. Next time.
2025, Will Clark confirmed.
Let's make it work, definitely. Fuck, it's 2025. I forget you're doing it on it's January, isn't it? So it's 2024.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm always like a, 14-month cycle ahead for like what's coming next. I mean, this one's 2024, but I got to, I'm in the process of planning the route and booking everything now for 25.
Dude, we had some good times.
A lot of good times.
It's fucking hell, man. I think my first time was 20, 2016?
1742. 2016, what, on the ship? Yeah. Or at Abbard or what?
On the ship.
Yeah.
That was the first time for me. What was the whole, I want to go back onto that. What was the whole like concept? What was the whole, why did you even start that?
So the story goes, I basically, in 1997, I got invited to this party. It was called The Move.
Yeah.
And it was sponsored by Camel Cigarettes. And it was based, it was from it was these like crazy techno people from Germany.
Yeah.
They did a few different events in North America, and one of them was on a ship, and we went out of Miami and we went to like a private island in the Bahamas. And, it was like, it was the best time I ever had in my life. And, I met a girl, it was funny. It was like, it, I think in 97, I have to look it up, but remember the Macarena?
Yeah.
I met a girl named Macarena and we had the best time. And it was like, it was just really fun. And, I always thought like, man, if I could ever recreate this, I would.
Yeah.
And then I kind of forgot about it. You know, they did one actually, they had a move in the desert in Vegas, and they said it was Area 51.
Yeah.
You know, we took buses, but it was like this crazy, brand. And then when I got hard going, I just had that idea in the back of my head, if I could ever do a ship. And then one of my partners said they did a cruise. And then I went and looked at the ship. It was the MSC, the Posia was the first boat that we ever did.
Yeah.
And that was 2012. And they're like, yeah, we could rent this whole ship. I'm like, we get this whole thing. Cause like we were on like a little shitty, like 300 person. It probably was a cargo ship. Yeah. I don't even know what it had rooms, but it was a pile of shit boat. But this thing is like, you know, casinos, restaurants. Yeah. I was like, they're going to let us have this whole thing. And they're like, yeah, whatever you want. And so that's how it all started. Right. My wife was like, you're crazy. No one's going to go, you know, it's after Christmas. No one's going to go. I'm like, trust me. Everyone's like, are you sure? Cause it's, you know, it's a really expensive venture if you get it wrong.
Oh, 100%. I can, how, like, obviously you don't have to go into details if you can't, but how much does it cost to just rent a fucking ship?
I mean, it's multiple seven figures.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine.
It's millions, you know, and like, they don't play games. So it's like, if I rent it and I don't sell any cabins, it's like me and you are going.
Yeah. Yeah.
We get it all to ourselves. And you have to, like I was saying, you have to get it in a way in advance. Cause they're like an airline.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're booking like a year out. So like when they give me the ship, they take it out of service.
Yeah.
So it's a, you know, it's a big problem if it goes back into service too late.
Mm. Yeah. That must be very fucking stressful.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, you know, always producing events are stressful.
Just, yeah.
You know, I'm used to it, but it's definitely, you know, it's not for the faint of heart. You know, everybody wants to do it, but nobody actually realizes what's involved. And, you know, I've had the conversations with I think it was Paul T, you know, Paul T who runs Coachella. If you haven't lost $1 million promoting shows, you're not a real promoter. But so I'm in that club.
What's been your biggest loss? If you don't mind me asking, the reason why I'm asking is because I think it's really important for people to actually know the like shit that goes on behind closed doors.
Worst. I think the worst was Hard Summer 2009.
Yeah.
Hard Summer 2009. I sold out the Forum. Mm. You know, I sold out the Forum. The Lakers play there, you know, LA, like that's like my home. And then, you know, my kids were really young, and then I came home. I probably was home at like 10 at night, you know, supposed to end at 4 a.m. My wife said, what are you doing home? And, you know, we got shut down, and, I had to give everyone their money back. And then I still had to pay for the whole show.
Yeah, of course.
Like you never think you're going to like if you, let's say you do a show and it's going to cost $1 million to produce the show, you never think you're going to sell zero tickets. Like maybe you sell $400,000 worth of tickets and you lose $600,000 or whatever, but you never sell zero. So this was
that's a kick in the teeth. How do you overcome that? How do you overcome that though as a promoter? Like, because that's a lot of money to kind of lose.
Yeah. I mean, well, thank God, you know, I owned a home, and so I was able to borrow the money and pay everyone and keep my reputation. I think that's what made me a real promoter, though. Like Paul said, you know, I all the agents, everyone, they were like, okay, this guy's for real. Mm-hmm. You know, like I paid everyone and I just took it on the chin. And I was like, I know I got something special with my brand.
Mm.
But that was not fun.
No, I can imagine that. Does that put stress? Put stress on your personal life as well?
Oh yeah, I mean it's brutal. I mean my wife. I mean you know, my kid. Basically, when my daughter was born in 2006, that's about when I started hard.
Yeah,
and you know, before that, I made records and had record labels.
Yeah,
so I'd always make you know compact discs, right? Like. You know, cassettes, CDs, right? These things.
Yeah.
And then in 2006, nobody does that.
No.
So I thought, well, maybe I could go back to what I did in the early 90s and like, DJ and produce a show again because you can't get the show for free on the internet.
Yeah.
It has just been it's always a struggle, but it's all worth it. You know, like the good times, like I'm sure like in your mind, like you just, like you see me and you think of all the fun times we've had, all these shows.
Totally. Yeah.
So, you know, it's my job to give, it's my pleasure is seeing everyone else have fun. You know, that's been kind of my life.
How, when it comes to like a show being closed down by the police or fire department and things like that, does insurance never kick in?
Well, on that one, so I had a partner.
Yeah.
And he was the first person I called because I, you know, at that point, this was 2009. I'd been doing, you know, shows again for like 2 years.
Yeah.
And so I was like, hey, we got insurance for this, right? And he's like, no, we don't have cancellation. So after that, I kind of went on my own and I made sure I've had insurance on everything. To be honest with you, the bigger issue for me was I didn't really know the city people, like the fire, the police. Like I had a whole team that dealt with that for me.
Mm.
And I was more like, you know, hanging out with you guys, booking artists, marketing. And I realized like, okay, I need to know who's in charge of this city and what's going on and the police and the fire. Cause when that was all happening, I ran into the room and was like, what's going on? And they're like, who are you?
This is
my event. Like I'm going to lose the money. And they're like, we don't even know who you are. Like it's already decisions made.
Wow.
So, but it depends on why it gets shut down and what the problem is, you know. But insurance will cover for, in my entire career as a concert promoter, I've never had an insurance claim ever.
Really?
I've had people sue us and they didn't win because we've always done our due diligence. So we're not negligent. But I've never had any claim on the other end where like I got something back because, something went wrong and the insurance worked out in my favor.
Do you get sued often?
No. When I was at Live Nation, there was a couple things, you know, that happened and they go to court. And then the amount of planning and you know, safety and health and safety, what we do, whenever there's been issues, it's always like if those issues would have happened anywhere else, the outcomes would have been way worse.
Yeah. Totally.
You know, we're very well planned and prepared. We kind of wrote the book on like how to do that, those kinds of things.
Well, I think this is the thing as well. And I think a lot of people don't realize this is even as artists at these shows, especially the big, like the festivals, and it's only the festivals that ask for it. Even the DJs need public liability insurance.
Oh yeah.
And
you need, I mean, especially like on the ship. So we're carrying the insurance for everybody else because most of your coverage doesn't cover like at sea.
Yeah.
So if you were coming on Friendship this year, we would indemnify you on our policy because our policy will pick it up.
Yeah.
So like all that paperwork needs to be proper because the insurance companies, their job is to make sure they don't have to pay.
Exactly.
So they're going to look at every angle to not pay.
Yeah.
So the real key to it is that my contract with you spells out all those details properly. And then we're both covered. So if something happens, then we're taken care of.
Yeah.
And that just, you know, that's just having good lawyers and good insurance people on your side to like make sure the paperwork's correct.
And that will cost so much money.
Yeah. Yes and no. I mean, it seems like it does, but like when you're dealing with it all the time, if you have the right people, it's just like making sure like your company name and your name is, it's just like you have to cover me and we cover you. Like when you're doing deals with the venues, it's just the paperwork has to be proper.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess with American sue culture as well, it has to be even more stringent on what you guys, because I've never had to do that for a festival anywhere else in the world apart from America personally. I don't know if you
have having like your own liability. Your personal insurance. I think it probably is, as you said, sue culture.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that term, but yeah, it seems like everybody here is suing for everything. I don't know.
Yeah. I want to go back to, I'm really interested in your life before Hard as well, and kind of your childhood and everything like that. And I'd love to kind of get into how it all started for you. I think that there's a lot of history there that a lot of people don't know about. And I know bits, but I don't know facts. And I'd love to get into that. So realistically, where did music start for you, or music industry start for you?
Well, I guess it started when I was born, because my dad, you know, my dad's in the music industry. So my dad was he's still in the music industry. but I was born in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And he was on the radio, and he also was a concert promoter.
Okay.
So I guess the way it worked back then was he played the record, and then the artist would come and play a show for him. So, but the artist that he had like Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
You know, so like Black Sabbath would come play like at a roller skating rink for my dad.
Sick.
And then he would play them on the radio. And then me and my brother were probably 5 years old, 6 years old, he started taking us to all these concerts.
Yeah.
So I just remember seeing, you know, Led Zeppelin, Rush, Ted Nugent, Van Halen, Jackson 5.
Yeah.
So yeah, just always been around music. And then my dad moved to New Orleans. So as the 80s progressed, he switched from like, 'cause my dad was more like pop radio.
Yeah.
So he was more like whatever was popular is what he was into. So it was rock, but then it switched to like disco. Then it switched to like funk.
Yeah.
So like the disco funk era was when he moved to New Orleans. I think that's when I got a lot of input into my head of like music that like Rick James, the Gap Band, Africa. He was on the station in New Orleans. They were the number one radio station in New Orleans when I was like 12.
Yeah.
And
how was it growing up in New Orleans?
Well, I was only there for 2 years.
Yeah.
It was a little weird for me. I didn't really know people, but you know, like had like my little bike and go to the mall and play Pac-Man or whatever, you know, just being a kid. But the music was there because my dad had the number one station. It was like an urban station, like black music.
Yeah.
So he was on the radio like 3 to 7, and he has a really deep voice. And people, they thought my dad was black, you know. And then he had a club called The Famous.
Okay, that's a great name.
Take me and my brother to The Famous.
That's such a good name.
So like Friday night, we'd be at The Famous, and I'd be like I would do the lights, and the lights were just like on or off switches, like 40 of them. So I'd like be turning the lights on and off. And my dad would have he had the super freak contest.
Okay.
So whatever girl got the freakiest in the club, she won like $105. 'Cause that was the radio station was called Way 105.
Okay. Yeah.
And then my dad moved to LA. And so then we moved to LA and I went to high school here. And then that's when I really got into like, you know, the Beastie Boys. Like at my high school, the Chili Peppers went to my high school. So when I was in high school, like we'd have a show at the Palladium. I'm sure you probably, did you sold out the Palladium or something?
No, I've never played there.
But the Palladium is kind of historic. You know, I'd go there when I was in like a junior in high school, and it would be like Fishbone, the Beastie Boys, Chili Peppers, and like Run DMC. That would be like that would be the bill, you know, Jane's Addiction. And so I just always was around that. And then, you know, I kind of was into break dancing, and then I started getting like turntables in high school. I had like the Radio Shack, belt drive.
And was your dad still in radio now at this point?
Yeah, kind of. He kind of consults with record labels and things like that.
Okay.
So that's my whole life I've been around it. And then, And then when I started going to college, I went to a warehouse party.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, now I know why I like hip hop, because of the sounds in hip hop. I didn't really know, like, the 808s and I didn't, you know, you don't know that shit when you're listening to the record, but I knew, like, when I was 16, I had my car with the 6x9s and the mirror would rattle. Like, I love that. But then I also like Kraftwerk.
Yeah.
You know, so I remember the record, I had Electric Cafe, and my dad played Kraftwerk on the radio.
Yeah.
Like, he played like Tour de France and Numbers and things like that. So, like, I would hear it like rattling my car and I was like, you know, stoked to drive around. And then I saw like a warehouse party with no rapping and just the synths and the drum machines. I was like, what is this? And then that's really when I started to like put two and two together. And then my first party that I ever did, it was called The Sermon. Mm. So it was like Sunday morning, 6 a.m. And next thing you know, I got like $3,000-$4,000 in my pocket.
What year is this?
1990,
yeah,
90, 91. You know, I was delivering pizza,
yeah,
going to college, like, and the people I was delivering pizza with had graduated from college. So I was kind of like, well, maybe I'll just do this club and DJ. It's a lot more fun,
yeah,
and I'm making some money. And then the Sermon turned into the Holy Water Adventure, which was at a water park.
Okay.
And then,
and what year was that?
1991.
Okay. What, so the Holy Water stuff was in 1991 as well?
Yeah. And so basically I did the Sermon, right? So, and, but we would go, me and my friends would go to the big Saturday night, you know, you guys would call it a rave.
Yeah.
You know, we called them undergrounds.
Okay.
And they were in warehouses, right?
Yeah.
And the guy who kind of had the best party, his name was Mr. Kool-Aid. And Kool-Aid's party was called Double Hit Mickey. So it was always like, where's Double Hit Mickey? If we could find Kool-Aid, like, that's where the party was.
Yeah.
Then I figured I couldn't compete with Kool-Aid. So I'll do like the morning, like, yeah, after, because everyone used to come back to our apartment,
okay,
and fuck up our apartment. I was like, well, let's take them to a club instead of like ruining our apartment. And so we started the Sermon. So it was 6 a.m. Sunday morning. And the most people that came, they were English.
Yeah.
Like in Santa Monica, you had a lot of English dudes that would show up, Guinness, watching football. So it was like Sunday morning, you know, so they would come. And it was like, okay, we're starting to get a following. It was mostly English people. And then we decided to do Midnight Mass. That was the second one.
Yeah.
And then the third one, we had the idea for the water park. And so I went to Kool-Aid and I was like, hey, I got this water park. And he was like, okay, we'll do it. And so we called it, Magical Mickey's Holy Water Adventure, because I was Sermon, he was Double Hit Mickey. And it went really well. And so then that's when it rolled into, then he came into my apartment and he said, we're going to do an Electric Daisy Carnival. And then I was like, what's that? And then he goes, well, we're going to have like a Ferris wheel and a fire eater, a bearded lady, like guess your weight booth. So that was called Magical Mickey's Electric Daisy Carnival. So that's how that kind of all, this was all, I was like 20 years old. I had no, you know, this was, we were just having fun.
It's really interesting how all those names are still around to a certain extent, right?
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
And like how you kept like the Sunday Sermon on Ship, you did it. Obviously, Holy Ship was your old venture and EDC was your old venture. Like, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, sometimes I don't even believe it, you know, like, yeah, it's weird because it's like seems like lifetimes ago, but it's the same themes. And it was kind of the genesis of the whole movement, you know. It's funny, I have this on my desk. I didn't put this here. This is just sitting here, but this article, this magazine was in 1991.
Yeah.
And see right here, it says Outlaw Parties on the Run in LA.
Oh yeah.
And so what happened was, and like, this was
that's so that good.
That was not a good sign. But basically what happened was, this guy, his name is Legs McNeil.
Yeah.
And Legs McNeil is a big writer. And he came up with the word punk. Like, he coined that word.
Yeah.
And he followed us around to the water park party. I had no idea who he was.
Yeah.
And he wrote this massive story in here. And that became like all of a sudden everyone in America read that and they're like, we want to do that in our city.
Yeah. Wow.
Kool-Aid was like, what are you doing? Like, why are you? Because it was underground.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoops, it wasn't underground anymore after that. So just, yeah, it's pretty wild times, you know. I mean, never could have envisioned anything of what happened. And to be honest with you, all we were doing was trying to copy what you guys were doing in Manchester.
Yeah, yeah.
Like at the Hacienda, you know, Happy Mondays and 808 State. And, you know, for me, it's always like music, you know, like I always just go to the music, you know, that's what drives me.
How did you even know about those though in the 90s? Like, was it, what was there like a thing that would tell you about it? Like how was that even kind of known?
So the first time I went to one of these clubs or warehouses, I heard 808 State Cubic.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what it was, but what I did was the next day I called this record store called Street Sounds. This guy, Barry Weaver, worked there. Barry Weaver. He was like, you know, he was like one of the best. It was like Barry Weaver, Doc Martin, Mr. Cool. And I called and I you know the track, right? It goes bam, 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 bam. I go, do you have that record? And he goes, oh yeah, that's 808 State. Come on down. I got that. And I was like, okay. And then I went down there and he handed me like a stack of records.
Yeah.
And you know, the turntable, and you could just listen to the records. Mm-hmm. And then like I bought all the records he gave me. It's so funny because I have them. I still have all, like this one right here. Like, see if you know this one. This one right here. It's funny. I got Show and Tell, Go Bang, GTO,
so
Pure.
Good. So good.
But like, I probably bought this record at that
time.
Meeting. And then when I got home, I didn't even have a record player.
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck. Like, I was just so hyped up to like hear this music. Cause I never heard electronic music without singing.
Yeah.
You know, I love Depeche Mode. I love Nine Inch Nails. I love Kraftwerk, but I never heard like just thumping. So I started investigating and I started buying, you know, I would start buying records all the time. And I just started putting two and two together that it was all coming out of England. And then, I found out about the Hacienda and I did my home, you know, I when it comes to music, like I just dig, you know, I'm a selector. Yeah. Digger, you know, like that's just what I always want to have the new music. And then what really got going was then Rick Rubin started coming to my events.
Okay.
And I was like, holy shit, that's like Rick Rubin. Like, you know, I was selling the tickets and then Kool-Aid was setting up the warehouse.
Yeah.
And so Rick was like, you know, coming. So I went over to him and I was like, hey, like, you know, this is my event. He gave me a cell phone. I'm like, you know, I put him on the list. He started coming all the time. And I guess because my name has been Destructo the whole time.
Yeah.
And I think he always envisioned like people that like Slayer. We're going to like electronics. I think he envisioned like Skrillex, you know, like he envisioned like heavy, like dubstep. And my name was Destructo. So I think he was like, oh, I want to see what this Destructo guy is playing. And then he asked me if I knew anybody that would do A&R and, you know, help him sign artists.
Wow.
And I was like, I'll do it.
Yeah.
So he hired me.
No way. So I did not know that.
Yeah, so he hired me to work at Deaf American in 1993. And then when he hired me, he sent me to Europe to go raving. He goes, just go for the summer and like see what's going on over there. So I went to a party. It was called Universe in Warminster.
Yeah.
Which is kind of near Stonehenge.
That's so random.
Yeah.
Such a random place.
Yeah, in Warminster. And I remember dudes were like doing hacky sack.
Yeah.
And they had like a bungee jump. But it was the thing was, I was always really keen on XL recordings.
Yeah.
Amazing. And so I signed XL recordings to Rick Rubin's label.
Yeah.
So when I went over there, the Prodigy played that rave. So they took me to the rave. I went with Richard and all those guys from XL. And you know, I just became a student of like all this shit from
how,
like the beginning.
How did that do in America? Like just generally.
Oh, it didn't do shit.
Yeah.
Here's what we signed. We signed Svenvath.
Yeah.
I signed Svenvath. I signed Messiah. I signed Lords of Acid.
Yeah.
I signed XL Recordings. We had everything, you know,
yeah.
But we sold no records, nothing.
So it was at that time, was Rick really into it? Like,
yeah, he loved it. He, because Rick, you know, the thing about Rick is I learned, I'm so fortunate that I got to, you know, that I know him and, you know, he taught me so, like, everything that I do is because of, you know, I learned it from him. But he doesn't care about if it's successful, right? Like the money, he's just into the art. So like I would go, he would call me up literally at like 4 a.m. And his nickname for me, by the way, at the company, I was called Techno Boy. That's what they call me. And he was like, Techno Boy, come over. Let's listen to some techno, right? Because we always call in like 92, I called it techno because in my mind, it was made with technology.
Yeah. That was the whole point behind it, right?
Techno. Yeah. Back then, techno was basically electronic.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So to me, everything was techno. It's so funny because now techno is like a genre.
Yeah.
But he'd be like, let's listen to some techno, you know? So I go over there and we put on some banging, like 140 Rotterdam, 150. Yeah. He'd be like rubbing his beard. Like, you know, he just loved it. I was like, I'm fucking at Rick Rubin's house. We're rocking out to like techno music. This is great. You know, but at the company, it didn't sell any records. So they were always like, oh, you and Rick eating ecstasy. What's wrong? Like we weren't doing that. Never did any of that with Rick. They had like the Black Crowes, they had Slayer, they had Sir Mix-a-Lot. He signed like Andrew Dice Clay, like, you know, so this was like one of Rick's weird like projects was electronic music, but the people at the label, they didn't get it. And Rick never came to the label.
Yeah.
So when I got there, like on day one, they're like, oh, you're that guy Rick hired that does that weird music. Like, leave us alone. Like, we have real music to deal
with. We need to make money.
Yeah, I was like, what? Like, I didn't even understand what they were talking about. It was weird.
So that was your first A&R job?
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty big first A&R job.
Yeah, well, it was like, because I asked Rick in his, you know, I was sitting there in his Rolls Royce when he like hired me or whatever, when he asked me if I knew anybody that would do this. And I was like, I'll do it. But I asked him, I said, you made the Beastie Boys License to Ill.
Yeah.
Like that is like, that's my high school. Like, that's like my everything, you know, like what's the secret? Like what, okay, how did you do that? And he just said, he just made it so he could drive around his car and listen to it. And I was like, what? So, but he was serious, you know, like, and I used that with Hard, like, okay, I just going to make a festival that I want to go to. Like, I just want to make, if I make a record, I want to make a record that like I'd play.
Yeah.
That's it. And my whole life has been that way of everything I've done, you know? And I'm like, I've never like chased something that's going to be big.
Yeah.
Or, oh, this is going to help me get bigger. Or like, I just go on like, okay, I'm in the studio with like Two Shorts. Like, what are we doing? I'm like, I don't know. Let's fucking have some fun. Like, let's like make a record about, I remember I was wearing a t-shirt that had these Rottweilers on it. And he's like, what's the song? I'm like, let's make a record about dogs. And he's like, cool, bro. And you know, he's like, every night I chase a cat. You know, and he wrote this whole rap about this dog that goes out and fucks all these dogs and cats in the neighborhood. So like just following my like heart of like what I would want to do or see, because that's what I learned from Rick, you know.
I think there's also something really beautiful about that it's like, when obviously there's business involved with everything and there's stress when there comes business and finances, but at the end of the day, if you are purely doing it because you love it, because that's what you want, because that's what makes you happy, in the grand scheme of things, whether it's successful or not, it doesn't really matter if you can step away from the finance side of things, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have so many records. I mean, like this, it's so funny. This shit's sitting on my desk. This record right here.
Yeah.
This is a Depeche Mode tribute album that I made.
Yeah.
Amazing. And like, I'm so proud of this record, you know, and like probably no one's ever, I mean, it actually did pretty well. I mean, it has The Cure and the Smashing Pumpkins, Rammstein. I mean, but it's like, it was a labor of love. Like I love Depeche Mode. So I was like, oh, I'm going to do a tribute album for Depeche Mode, 'cause I just love them and they have such good songs.
Yeah.
And then what happened with this thing, I had all these crappy bands that were covering Depeche Mode. I couldn't get anybody big to do it. And then, Martin Gore was having lunch with, can't think what's the singer for The Cure? Robert Smith.
Yeah.
He was having lunch with Robert Smith. He's like, oh yeah, there's some kids in California that are doing a tribute album for us. And Robert Smith was like, oh, I always had an idea for World in My Eyes. And then the next thing you know, like a month later, I get a DAT tape, shows up in my office, The Cure covering Depeche Mode.
Amazing.
Like, I'm just lucky, you know what I mean? Like, it just dropped into my lap. Then the next thing you know, it's on MTV. You know, 1500 Records producing Depeche Mode tribute album, The Cure covering, then everybody wanted to be on the record. So yeah. It was just a cool idea that I thought of with my friends, and then it turned out to be something like much bigger. But it was never like, let's do this because we're going to make money.
Were you at Deaf America then?
No, what happened here? So what happened after Deaf American was, so, you know, after about 2-3 years of working there, like, we didn't sell any records, like none. I think we sold minus records.
Yeah.
So I ended up leaving, and then
did you leave or get fired?
I left because I also, you know, because my dad and my brother are in the business.
Yeah.
I was also helping them get songs on the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was doing really good at that.
Yeah.
But I wasn't doing good with my electronic, and I didn't care about getting shit on the radio. Yeah. I wanted to make records. I didn't want to like be the plugger. Yeah. You know, I wanted to be the artist or work with the artist. But so then they had me start working songs at radio.
Yeah.
And my brother was like pushing me in that regard to do that, so I ended up leaving. It left really cool with Rick. But what happened was in 1997, when the Firestarter got on MTV, all of a sudden, like, everyone in America is like, they wanted to sign the Prodigy. And so my brother was having a meeting with an exec at a label, and they're like, you ever heard of this band, the Prodigy? Like, we got to sign them. And my brother was like, oh, I think my little brother signed them already. Like, he knows them. and because my older brother, he would always tell me that my music sucked. He's like, dude, that electronic, it's garbage. Like, there's no songs, there's no vocals. There's no, you're all on drugs. Like, you're an idiot. Like, you need to listen to Bruce Springsteen. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And so I went and took a meeting with this guy, and he was like, yeah, could you help me sign the Prodigy? And I was like, well, I know Richard, who owns XL. Like, I could put you in touch. I mean, I can't make the decision for them, but I can make a connection. But what are you going to do for me?
Yeah.
And he's like, we'll give you your own label. And I was like, really? And they're like, yeah. And so I told my attorney, and he's like, well, they want to give you their label. You should go meet with everybody.
Yeah.
But like in 1997, when Firestarter was like a buzz clip on MTV, every record company offered me like my own record label.
Wow.
Because I was like the only guy that knew all the groups. Like, I'm like, well, there's more than the Prodigy. There's the Underworld. There's Chemical Brothers. There's Orbital. There's Fatboy Slim. There's fucking 808s. Like, there's a whole thing.
Yeah.
It's not just this, but they just wanted the one because it was on MTV. You know, they don't know.
No.
So I got a label deal with A&M Records in 1997, and then this was on that label.
I'm not aware of A&M. Should I be?
You know, well, yeah, A&M was Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. I mean, it was a huge independent label. Like, they had like Soundgarden and Janet Jackson. Okay. And see, what happened is A&M merged. They actually merged when I was there.
Yeah.
So A&M was like, I think like Herbie Hancock. They had a lot of jazz. Like, A&M was a really like Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss, the two guys that ran it.
Yeah.
They were like OGs like in the 60s and 70s. But then what happened was they sold. So you know how everything gets like bought up?
It's Polydor now, right?
It became A&M and Polydor, and then they got bought by Universal.
Yeah.
So they kind of merged together. And that's what happened to me. I was in the middle of all that. Mm. And so the guy that brought me in actually got fired. And so they were like, you could, and he was like, I'll give you your masters back, or you could go meet with Interscope and see if they want to keep you.
Yeah.
So I met with Jimmy Iovine and Ted Fields and Tom Wally and all them. And they're like, we love your, you know, we think you have great taste in music, but your shit doesn't sell. They're like, sign some shit like your brother, you know, sign some shit like your dad. Cause, you know, my brother managed Slipknot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my brother, Slipknot sent me their demo, and I gave it to my brother cause I had an electronic label at A&M.
Yeah.
At A&M, while I worked there, they sent me their demo. And so he went off and dealt with them. But when I went to Interscope, you know, had all this electronic music, and they were like, we think you have good taste, but it just doesn't sell. And so that didn't really work out either. Cause I always stuck to my guns. Like, I was like, look, I remember telling Jimmy Iovine, I'm like, in the year 2000, In the year 2000, a sampler and a computer is going to change like the way music, you don't understand. Like I couldn't even imagine Napster or Spotify, but I knew the computer was going to change how it was made, because I signed a band called God Lives Underwater.
Yeah.
In like 90 at Deaf American. You know Josh Wink is?
Yeah.
Josh Wink introduced me to God Lives Underwater. And God Lives Underwater, they're from Pennsylvania. And they were the first guys that ever had a MIDI studio.
Yeah.
And they moved in with me. And then I had a MIDI studio in my room. And we had three MIDI studios in our house. And like, I was just blown away that you don't need a drummer.
Yeah.
Like you don't need, I was trying to explain to my brother, like, you don't need a drummer. You know, why do we need a dude who can't keep time? Like we got fucking breakbeat, you know, where we could sample a drummer and then like chop it up. And like, you know, that was like revolutionary. Yeah, you know, we were like, you know, so we were making our own breakbeats and doing all that shit. I just learned all that really early, you know, not really like as a student of like, I can actually program it, but like always being in the room with the dudes who are like doing it. And I would see that compared to how a band would record. And I'm like, this is the future. Like, it's not going to be four guys in a garage.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Ivey and them were like, you're fucking crazy. You're like, what are you talking about? And then to be honest with you, those guys, I think, you know, they need to make their numbers.
Of course. It's a corporation, isn't it?
Business. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the best, to close on the whole thought, though, was really cool, though, is I did run into Rick not too long ago, and he invited me out to his house in Malibu.
Oh, wow.
And we were, like, looking out over the Pacific Ocean. He goes, we were right.
Yeah.
He goes, we were right. He goes, it's so funny. He's looking over my shoulder. He goes, we were right. He goes, we were 20 years too early. He goes, but we were right. Here, let me show you this. It's so funny. I finally got all my shit, like, in one place. So this picture right here, I don't know if you can see it.
Yep.
So that's me and Rick.
Where are you on the left?
I'm next to him here.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this guy right here, that's Richard Russell.
Oh, is it? Wow.
Yeah. And then we're holding Johnny Cash's guitars. So Rick was recording the Johnny Cash, you know, all those songs with Johnny Cash before he passed away up at his house. So that was when we signed him. I think the deal was for $10,000.
Wow. In the 90s?
Yeah, it was like 94 maybe, something like that. You know, because, you know, XL was like a breakbeat label. They had SL2. Do you know SL2?
Yeah. XL was British 90s rave institution.
Yeah.
Still, Richard, like, and it's amazing how they've done it, right? Now they do Adele.
Yeah, and Richard signed Adele. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, we're still buddies. Like, it's just amazing that, you know, Richard just started out. He was just a techno DJ like me. We met like at New Music Seminar. Mm. And like, I would go out there and just hang out with them. And he signed Radiohead, Basement Jacks, Jack White. Like, you know, Richard's the man.
Yeah, it's amazing especially how iconic certain record labels, even like Interscope, for example, right? Like how long they've been doing what they've been doing and the amount of artists that they brought to the industry that are literally the biggest artists in the world.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. It's weird though that it's like, you know, now I think in music, like, you know, there's all these characters in the music business.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's just replaced with like an algorithm, and it's you know, like all the best artists were always passed on by all the record labels.
Yeah.
You know, the best ones, because they don't fit the formula.
Yeah. But what do you think when you talk about algorithms and how it is today, what's the pros and what's the cons? Or is it all cons?
Yeah, I mean, I think music's like from the heart. It's got to be like handpicked.
Yeah,
you know, like when it starts being picked by a computer or by habits, like, it's so funny. I know we're talking a lot about Rick, but like, I don't know if you saw, he was on 60 Minutes, because, you know, he just released a book.
Yeah,
he put out a book.
Yeah, the book's good.
And the clip is because he used to say this to me. He says the audience comes last. The audience only knows what they heard last time. They don't know what we're cooking up for them tomorrow, but the algorithm just keeps telling you what they heard before.
Yeah.
So it gets stuck. That's why music always is stale and sucks, because you're getting shit that people know that they like, but they don't know what's coming next.
Yeah.
You got to, our job, you know, my job, your job is deep. Our job is to lead them to the next thing. But if you're just following the algorithm, what they say they like, you're just serving them up the same shit that they, you're not progressing.
I've never thought of it like that. And it's so true.
Yeah. So you need somebody to kind of hand, you know, someone's got to go in there and go, okay, well, because I remember when I first started making tunes again, and I went and worked with the Oliver guys, and they were like, so what do you want to make? You know, they're going to help me make some shit. And they basically gave me, they had like a bunch of tracks that sounded like Justice and a bunch of tracks that sounded like Deadmau5.
Yeah.
And I was like, guys, there's already Justice and Deadmau5.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what's going on now. It's like, you know, Chris Lake, and then everybody sounds like fucking Chris Lake. Yeah. It's like, just move on, come up with something new.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I was like about you. Like, your sounds, like, you're unique to you. You know, you, whenever you send me records, they always sound fresh and unique. And like, I always listen to your tracks, and they're always dope, and I always play them, because you don't really follow the formula of like what's hot. Like, you just do your own thing.
I appreciate that.
But that's especially electronic music, right? We all got the same tools.
But I guess, yeah, and I totally agree. And it's a conversation that I've had so many times personally and on this podcast. And I think the thing for me that's changed all of this, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. What are your thoughts? What's changed?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's less guys like me with influence to push it through to the top. I'm one guy, but you know, I don't have I think I had a big platform to insert a lot of new shit into places, which I don't have anymore. So those like special little places to insert new things are gone.
Yeah.
And everybody that wants to be like a producer, that wants to be a DJ, they're just going to make shit that sounds like Chris Lake.
Yeah.
Cause that's just what they think what they need to do, but they need to like come up. What's the next Chris Lake? Like, what's the next sound?
Yeah.
Right. Electronic music's all about the sound.
But
right.
Then, but then again, I 100% agree with you, but I guess when you talk about, the algorithms with Spotify,
right, you're not going to get in the algorithm.
You're not going to get any new, and then no one's going to hear. I have this conversation a lot at this moment, and like even with my label, like the people that I'm signing, even the records that I'm releasing. Like I've released for the last 2 years. Okay, every record I've released on a streaming level has drastically gone down on the streaming numbers. And that's purely because it just doesn't get put in front of the people on those things. We only have a certain amount of power as artists using social media, blah, 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 for it to be put in front of those people. But when the gatekeepers at the top of these places aren't willing to kind of support fresh new music and new music that's like interesting. And I'm not saying that I should deserve that, because I don't. I'm saying somebody should deserve that's putting new fresh music out, and it doesn't sound like everybody else. If you've got gatekeepers at the top, that new music's never going to come through. It's never going to. And there's always been gatekeepers, right? There always will be gatekeepers, and there's nothing wrong with that. But for me, it's like, how does something come through that's not just based on a gimmick nowadays?
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough, but it'll happen because, I mean, look, the reason why electronic music didn't break through in the 90s when I was like first started, the gatekeepers was MTV.
Yeah.
And the radio.
Yeah.
So on MTV and the radio, they played grunge and they played hip hop.
Yeah.
So there was no room for electronic music. So when Rick and I were doing this, it was like there was no outlets.
Yeah.
But, you know, Rick's theory is the cream rises to the top. Mm. So if it's really that good and groundbreaking, somehow it'll make its way through.
I agree.
I don't know. It's hard because Spotify does have a lock on it. But they need, you know, they need to, in my opinion, you know, and I don't work there, I have nothing to do with it, but they need some handpicked people. Like, I guess like a Pete Tong, you know, like there needs to be some people that handpick it instead of the algorithm picking it.
Yeah.
But at Spotify, they don't want people picking it. They want the algorithm picking it. You know, they want it to be that way because that's just the way their platform works, and it's successful.
Yeah.
But there just needs to be an alternative to that, right? Like there, and something will come because eventually it'll change, right? Because it can't just be the same. I compare it to McDonald's. You know, it's very much like it's just serve up as many burgers as you can. Keep them listening,
yeah,
and like just give them what they want, you know, and that's what most people think. But music is art, you know, and there's got to be another way. I don't know that I don't have the solution. I wish I did. I mean, like I had the same problem you have.
Yeah,
I started making rap songs over house.
Yeah,
and I didn't fit in any of the fucking algorithms.
Yeah.
Right. Like I'm not rap because they don't like house and house doesn't want rap.
Yeah.
But I know that like when I put it together at the festival, it's what everybody wanted,
yeah,
but it
yeah.
didn't work in the algorithm. I mean, I have records that I think should have hundreds of millions of plays. Mm. You know, they got millions of plays. That's just, you know, but it's cool. Like I'm happy with them. So
I think that's it. At the end of the day with the art is as long as you're happy with it, it will kind of keep going through. But it is still it's still very strange how it goes. And this isn't me moaning about it because I have a great career. Like I'm very fortunate that it actually, yes, I'd love my records to stream better. But realistically, I'm still getting booked and I still sell tickets. And I'm very fortunate for that. If you know what I mean, it's similar to you, right? You still sell tickets. You still run amazing parties and your whole career doesn't rely on your music, if that makes sense. However, it's sad that it doesn't because we are in the music industry and our foundations are music.
Well, you know, something to think about. We need an alternate platform. Mm. You know, because what streaming did, right? When streaming came about, it made me shift from recorded music to concerts.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to like see that.
Yeah.
And pivot. And that's where hard came, you know? And so that really gave me a career. But at the same time, my wife's at the door. What's up, man? At the same time, where was I going?
So streaming, basically, new platform, you went to hard.
Yeah. At the same time though, you know, there needs to be a way for new music to get through on a big level. Oh, I know. The point is that when the streaming came about,
yeah,
it also enabled us to get to all these people.
Yeah.
Because before that too, you know, we probably like, I mean, I guess what it is that, right, we have millions of plays,
yeah,
but we want to have hundreds of millions of plays.
Yeah.
So the streaming has connected everybody on such a level that the music is consumed like so much more. So you have a lot more like pockets of smaller people,
yeah,
than just a couple. Like back in the day before streaming, you had like Britney Spears and you had like U2, like you had these monster, you don't really have as much of that.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of like little niche ones.
Yeah.
But now it's turning again to where you have a couple key people like in our world
yeah.
that are benefiting, and then there's a lot that aren't. So I think there just needs to be an alternative, like to Spotify New Music Friday and, you know, the electronic New Music Friday and whatever their playlists are, right? And I don't know how you do that. I mean, I think I could be one of those people that could do something like that. Because, you know, what's so funny is I feel bad saying this, but I asked the people at BPM, at Sirius, you know, I'm good friends with them.
Yeah.
So you got the one channel that plays, let's call it EDM, right? The pop one, BPM, that's pop. Then I don't even know what they have, what they've got going on, but then they have the one channel that was like Tropical House. Remember that?
Yeah.
And then they have one channel that was like the mix shows.
Yeah.
So it's like the mixers of like the DJs from those two genres. So I said to myself, where's the channel that plays the good electronic music?
Yeah.
like if you had a fourth channel, where's the one that plays the Prodigy?
Yeah.
And the Basement Jacks and Skrillex and Will Clark.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Destructo and Kraftwerk and Depeche Mode. Where's that channel?
Yeah.
Why is that on the fucking radio?
Yeah.
Like I listen to K-Rock, right? Like my friends are on K-Rock. K-Rock is alternative. Like when I grew up, they were like they were cool.
Yeah.
They played Oingo Boingo. They played Depeche Mode. They played James Addiction. Now they just play Sublime and Social Distortion. Like, why don't they play Skrillex?
Yeah.
I don't understand. I don't. I mean, I'm kind of getting old now. So for me to like change the game, I don't know. But like, I feel like the perspective is so lost on electronic music because we have such a diverse history of amazing fucking electronic music and no one really taps into that. Like, why isn't there like a channel that plays that stuff? I don't know. It's mind blowing. It's like in rock music, they play Led Zeppelin. Right? You turn on rock radio, they play Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath. There's not one station that plays Basement Jacks and Prodigy, like Chemical Brothers. Why is it only the brand new Chemical Brothers song that came out? You hear it for a week and it's gone.
I agree. Like, there's no longevity in records. There's no longevity. And that's the thing, is like you work with your label team, you spend a month, 2 months prepping your record to be released and kind of promoting it and doing all of that. It gets released. If it doesn't get support within the first week, you're like, okay, maybe we get some next week. If you don't get support on the second week on playlist in any platform, you get forgotten about.
Yeah.
And the record's gone. And it's like, it just doesn't feel right. I just Googled it because I think it's absolutely fucking crazy. There's 9 million artists on Spotify, okay? And only 57,000 of them earned $10,000 or more.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other... The making money, even if you're doing 100 million streams, you're not making any fucking money.
No.
I mean, you're not getting... I mean, look, when I used to sell these, you could get like $10 a record.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, the distributor takes their piece and whatever. And then you could, you know, there's some money to go give to the artist, hire a publicist, make a video, do up. Now, like there's no money on any of that. It's all just a commercial for your live show. The whole thing's fucked up. I don't know. I mean, and also look, let's be honest. There's way too many people putting out music. Like I almost feel like there's more DJs than there are people that want to listen to DJs' music.
Totally. Yeah.
And like, you know, 98% of that, look, the thing is that most people that can make electronic music now, it sounds pretty good. Like, you know, you got all the tools to make it sound. You got AI. You could just go into AI and be like, make me a fucking song that sounds like Will Clark. And then, you know, I'm a DJ.
Yeah.
But it's like, what separates the boys from the men? You know, there's like, where's the, you know, the Skrillex?
Yeah.
You know, I would say like what would Jimi Hendrix be doing right now if he had a computer?
Yeah.
And he was alive. You know, like, where's that dude? Like, those are the guys I want to book and work with.
Yeah.
And they're just very few and far between. But then you have a ton of average. And if they're funny on Instagram or
TikTok,
they're good looking, then they're doing well.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, it's sad. I kind of look at it, it's not really my problem anymore. You know, like when I was 20, that was kind of my problem and I figured out ways to do it. Right. Like I pounded through with with events, with music, with different things. But now, like, I don't know what you do, but I think at some point it's going to have to go back to people picking by hand.
Yeah.
There's got to be a selector that picks, that gets a following, that people are like, okay, this guy knows what's up. Because that's how you always found out about music. It was like your cool buddy, your older brother that turned you on to something cool. It wasn't a fucking computer that just said, oh, if you like this, then you're going to like that. Then you're just going to end up eating shitty hamburgers.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
It's I don't know how to fix it, though. I wish I had the answer.
I have a concept for artists to make money on Spotify, and that is like adverts and sponsors. Okay. We all grew up with adverts on everything, right? TV, radio, et cetera, et cetera. And you have adverts on certain Spotify, certain podcasts, right? The bigger podcasts have a lot of adverts, right? And podcasts on Spotify and Apple don't get paid to stream, but you're allowed to put adverts on, and your page can have this podcast is sponsored by this person, blah blah blah. We're getting, let's just say, for instance, you're getting 1 million monthly listeners on your Spotify. To a corporation that wants to sell something, that is worth so much fucking money. 1 million regular users go into your page, go into your artist page, and listen into your music. That's mental. Okay. Why won't Spotify allow artists to put sponsorships on their page? Because it's a way to split revenue for everyone.
Well, because they're charging their fee and then they're taking the money for themselves.
Yeah. But let's take it back a little bit. Okay. Let's say, for instance, you have 1 million monthly listeners. I don't know, like Dyne Audio speakers, right? Come behind you and go, okay, we want to pay you for the next 6 months, $150,000 for us to sponsor your page. All right. You set up a deal with Spotify. You pay, Spotify takes 10%. All right. They're making their money. You make your money. Happy days.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great idea, but Spotify's never going to do that because they're already doing that and they're taking all the money.
And they're taking everything.
And, you know, like, we're the little guys. I mean, like, the big acts like The Weeknd and Beyonce and shit, they're playing ball. So,
well, they're playing ball to them because they pay them more.
Yeah, but still, they're still not getting paid. They're not getting paid. Like, if they were doing this, they'd be getting a lot more.
Yeah.
Like, so it's just, they're still getting the same fractions. It's just a larger fraction. Trust me, they're not happy either, but it's because they have all the trap that, you know, you have to be there, right? You have to be on Spotify and you have to have that positioning and you have to have those plays to then have everything else that falls into play.
Yeah.
So it's just a shift, right? Like, what happened is the music shifted, the business shifted from the money being made from the recorded music to the way I always look at it is the recorded music that we all make and love, that's our, you know, valuable to our souls, is just a commercial for everything else you do.
100%.
That's all it really is.
100%. Yeah, I totally agree.
And I have kids, you know, I have a 17-year-old daughter, you know, the concept of buying this
crazy
is like, this ain't worth, this is free.
Yeah.
This shit's free. Like, they don't understand. They're like, how much, this took me like 5 years to make this, to get all these fucking artists to record a Depeche Mode song for me and clear the paperwork with their attorneys and do all that work and get the artwork. You know, the guy that made the art was the guy that did all of Depeche Mode's, you know, all of Depeche Mode's fucking artwork. I hired him, you know, Martin Atkins, to, like, you know, we did a photo shoot out in the desert. We lit up the, you know, like you can't do shit like that anymore. It's just fun. Get it out there. Hopefully it gets in the algorithm. Like, it's not, it's just, I don't know. It's, I guess we're just living in the past.
Yeah. I don't know if it's about living in the past. I think it's living in reality. And it's like, when you have such a small percentage of artists that actually make money from music, it's kind of depressing. And yeah, you're right. There's way more artists doing it. Way more artists doing it. And maybe a lot of that percentage shouldn't even earn money because what they're doing isn't that great, high quality.
You know how many, Google, I don't know, you were looking up. questions. Google how many new tracks, I don't know if they'll have it, come on Beatport a week. You know, in my last job, I was the president of this company, Lifestyle. You know, we own Beatport.
Yeah.
So I like, you know, a lot of, you know, conversations with, I think it was when I was working there, it was like 30,000 songs a week.
Yeah.
It was 100,000 songs a week.
According to CEOs, there's 100,000 new songs being released every day.
Every day. I mean, fucking dude, like, yeah. So, you know,
that's over all DSPs.
Over all DSPs. Okay. Yeah. But still, like, it used to be, I mean, I tripped out in the beginning when I was starting hard at how many shows like Steve Aoki would play. Yeah. Steve Aoki still plays like 300 shows a year. Like when Slipknot puts out an album, they would make, like, the way it used to work, right, is you sign a band. You take that band and you go in a studio for like months.
Yeah.
You know, first you write the songs and you go in a studio for like months and you spend like a lot of money to make this record, right? It was like hundreds of thousands of dollars. You couldn't just like make it at your house. You had to go to a studio and get an engineer and get it, you know, to get the band recorded right. And then you make a plan, and the process of releasing that record takes, it's like a year long plan.
Yeah.
You put the record and then they go on tour.
Yeah.
And they tour. And then once they tour, they go, unless they have like a big hit, and then they can maybe go to bigger, they go away and they make another record.
Yeah.
And you do like one record a year or every other year, and you tour once. And dude, DJs, we're fucking playing every night, everywhere, all the time. It's like insane. Like, how many times can we see the same dudes?
Yeah.
But everybody still does it. You know, it's mind blowing. Like, there's not, I can't think of one, name me one DJ that just went away and came back.
Skrillex.
Boom. There you go. Look how big he is.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
but if he wasn't that big, he couldn't have done that.
True. That's, but I'm saying, even the guys at the top though, like the guys at the top, they're the ones that can make a difference.
Yeah.
Because they can set the tone, but they're just rinsing. Like, I think, like, when was the last time Diplo didn't play a show? Like, we look on Instagram right now, he's probably playing. And I love him. I love the hustle. I love Wes. Yeah. Like, God bless him. You know what I mean? Totally. But it's like, it's not how I learned. You know, I learned that, like, I mean, I think, look up how many shows Led Zeppelin played in their entire career.
Yeah.
I don't think Led Zeppelin played more than 300 shows their entire career. I could be wrong on that, but I think it's like 250 shows or something they played.
They performed over 600.
600 shows.
But that's nothing.
That's 2 years of that's 1 year of Diplo and Stevie Aoki touring. That's Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Led Zeppelin. That's like the best rock band ever in life, played 600 shows their entire career over fucking 15 years.
Okay. All right. Playing devil's advocate, right?
Yeah.
I don't really know the live, like the rock side, but how much does Led Zeppelin earn per show?
Back then, probably not even as much as they're getting, as fucking Aoki's getting now.
True. Yeah.
And they had, like, the funniest part of that shit is if you go and look at their setup, they're playing Madison Square Garden. They got fucking drum kit, an amplifier, a bass rig, a couple lights, and that's it. And they were killing it.
Yeah, but they made fucking great music.
Killing it. It's
great music.
Like, beyond belief. Yeah. With nothing. It's just a different time, dude. Like, so I mean, you know, I'm just older, right? So, like, I think I'm probably, like, the oldest dude that's, like, you know, like I was a little tiny kid. I saw Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, there's nobody that, like, DJs in our world that, like, saw Led Zeppelin.
No.
Like, that saw any of that or had a dad in the business. So, like, I kind of have this weird perception on the business because I've had it for like fucking 4+ decades of seeing everything. And it's just, you know, it's part of living in 2023.
Yeah,
like, my daughter, totally. Watch how my daughter listens to music. Like, she'll listen to like a verse and maybe a chorus
and then
skip, and then a verse and a chorus of like an album. And then, like, I watched her. She was doing this with, like, it was like Travis Scott's album, or she'll listen to like the verse and then get to the end of the album and then start again and then skip again. It's like, why not just listen to the whole album? they don't have attention. People don't have attention spans. Yeah. You know, people can't, like, no one would go and sit and listen to this whole album from start to finish. Like, I made it so that you would listen to it from start to finish. It's got 16 songs on it. Like, there's a theme between the whole thing. No one's going to listen to this shit for fucking, I mean, you know, it's weird. I don't know.
How has it changed with promoting shows? Because it's clearly changed as well. Like, especially post COVID, right? Like, how ticket sales are and everything like that. How have you seen it change from the 90s to now?
I've seen it change into multiple iterations, but I think where we're at now, I think it's the same thing. I think there's too many shows with the same shit.
Yeah.
You got to give them something different. Like, we've seen, everybody's seen the same thing. And I think that people are just programmed to just go.
Yeah.
Right. Like, oh, you're just going to go to the fucking whatever fucking Electric Wonderland rave. Cause that's what everybody does.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really matter who's playing. It's bad. Cause this is exactly where I was when Hard started. Right. I mean, all I can say is, you know, who's the new version and who's going to be the new Gary that's going to start a new brand that's, you know, got something completely different. I mean, I've got my ideas, but where's the 20-year-old?
Yeah.
You know, because to me, I always said, go to Electric Daisy Carnival when I first started Hard and ask any person there who's DJing right now. And I bet you they're either going to not know, or I think I sent someone to actually do this, and they either say Tiesto or they don't know. That's pretty much it, right? Like, they don't really fucking know.
Yeah.
You know, and then I started throwing in Crystal Castles.
Yeah.
I started throwing in fucking just hit them with something different, man. The same shit we've seen the same, like, I don't know, like, I wouldn't go see the same thing over and over and over again. Same. I'm trying to give something interesting and fresh. And I think that,
how do you do that on a business sense though? When like, talking as a promoter, like, how do you do that? Because you still have to book the headliners that are selling the tickets, right? You still need, because that they're the ones that people need book to buy the tickets.
It's the same thing, like you said. It's just the gatekeepers got it locked.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're in this age of music where you've got a couple key entities at the top that own everything, and so everything's just fucking stale, and it is what it is. And then somebody will come and knock the fucking door down and just do something different, and those people are going to just try to keep everyone else from doing that.
Yeah. So
it's a fight. You know, when I worked at Live Nation, they basically said, you know, their job is to protect the castle, right? They're like, at this point, they're playing defense.
Yeah.
And they can't let anybody get into the castle.
Yeah.
And my partner and I were there. We're like, what the fuck? What are we doing then? Because we were there. We're in the moat. He's like, we're in the moat with the shit. Like, you know? So it's like, there just needs to be competition, right? Like, there's no.
But how do you have competition when it comes to a company like Live Nation? And as much as I respect Live Nation and what they've done in the music industry, again, let's say, for instance, you're an independent promoter, right? You start becoming successful, Live Nation come and buy you out because they offer you so much money that you can't turn it down.
I don't know, man. Come over to my house and we'll listen to some cool tunes and have our own party. that's kind of where I'm at. I don't know how you fight them, you know? Like, I mean, I would hope, look, my hope, and I always keep the door open with Live Nation,
of course,
with Golden Boy and Spotify, all three. Maybe they would say, hey, we want to have like a Live Nation, like an offshoot that does something that's like cool and unique. That's not all about money, but it's like a give back to create some new cool shit.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be your first to hire me.
Yeah.
Right. I'm available. Like, I'd love to be in Spotify and have one playlist that's like handpicked by me.
Let
me give some new people a chance. Like, that's all I did. All Hard was me just picking shit that I liked that became all of you guys that fucking created this whole thing. And now we're right back to where we were before I was doing that.
Yeah.
We're just stuck in a rut of the same stuff again. So someone needs to come and kick the door open with something new, you know? And you're right. Like, it's very hard to fight those people, but you know, there's always, if there's a will, there's a way. And I would hope that those brands would say, hey, let's start a Live Nation Lite, you know, and we'll give five promoters that we think are cool, chances to create new cool things that open the doors for new people. That's what they should be doing. But then they're going to be like, well, fuck, we're going to lose money. But you might lose money in the beginning, but in the end, you'll develop something that's way cooler that will last, that can be the changing of the guard when the big things you have now get stale.
Well, you also create culture.
Yeah.
Which I think gets forgotten about a lot of what is this about. And I'm not just talking about electronic music. I'm talking about punk. I'm talking about hip hop. I'm talking about everything in those kind of subgenres. It's like there's culture that you need, the culture, you need the education, you need the new kids coming through, because otherwise, yeah, you're in a situation where like where everyone is. And I'm part of that as well. Like I play a lot of festivals. I get booked for a lot of festivals. Like I'm very fortunate that I'm in that situation that I can earn a living from that. However, like there comes a point when it's like you question why people are still coming to see you because it's like you've seen me, like I love it. I'm so fortunate that I have it, but I have people that have like messaged me this year and they're like, I've seen you six times. I'm like, I love it. Thank you so much. But like, why? Like,
right. Well, because you keep putting out new tunes and they know that you're going to, I mean, every time you play, I'm sure it's different and you serve up like a flavor that they love.
And they're not getting from anywhere else, I guess, potentially.
Yeah. But well, it's unique to you.
Yeah. But
right? I can't think of one artist when I think of you that's like similar to you. Like yeah. I just, you're unique. You know, I think the same with me, hopefully, but yeah, I don't think same. Like if somebody comes to see us that they're going to get the same thing every time and we're going to just play the same old top 10 fucking songs on Beatport or whatever.
Tech
plus
history,
yeah. Not only that, we've cultivated people that come to see us that like each other.
Yeah.
It's like,
it's community.
I know when I come, it's like, yeah, it's like a reunion of people coming together.
And that's something you've always done very well. And I've always kind of really respected that. Obviously for me, having like my first part of my career with Dirty Bird and them at that time doing that very well. And obviously coming onto the ship with you and seeing the, like the community that you created with the ships that with initially Holy Ship and now Friendship, like, that's really, I don't think people understand how hard that is to create a community and to build something that makes people feel part of something. And how did that initially start? Like I know how it started, but like, was that always a plan? Was that always a goal? Or is that just something that just happened?
It just, I mean, that was like the best thing that just it was organic because if we go back to the beginning of the conversation, like I just thought, all this music on the ship is going to be great because I had such a cool time doing that. And the venue's perfect, right? Like, especially this one for, you know, I want to talk a little about Friendship that's coming up. But the venue that I have, I mean, the ship has 21 floors.
Wow.
It's, I mean, the ship that I have this year is going to be like the last 12 years of all doing all these ships is going to culminate into this one being the best one.
Yeah.
But the audience, I wouldn't say the audience, I'd say the family.
Yeah.
Like that was all organic because on the first one, it was like everybody took a chance on this weird idea.
Yeah.
And everybody that went was all like into the same kind of music.
Yeah.
And then it brought everyone together and created this family that's like been together for like 10, 12 years. And I DJed 2 weeks ago in Florida and I had a girl come up to me and tell me that before she went on the cruise, like before she went into Ship Fam, that her life was like a downward spiral, that she was in a really dark place, like things weren't good. And then she went on one of the ships and met all these people. And ever since then, her life has been like amazing, like positive, and just felt like she belonged somewhere and like turned her whole life around. You know, to me, that's like the money, forget everything. Like the fact that like an event that I produced had that effect on a human is like incredible. And they can tell me about it and like give me a hug about it. And like that trumps everything.
I agree.
That's like organic though. You know, that wasn't my plan wasn't to have all these crazy people be connected through this event.
Yeah.
my plan was to have this fucking cool venue where we could all party.
Yeah,
then they all just like stuck together. You know, I think it's just a bunch of misfits that all came together.
Yeah, and it feels like that. And I don't mean that in a horrible way, but it's there's something so beautiful about it. And it is amazing what you've done, man. I really take my hat off to you, like just everything that you've achieved over the years and also still pushing forward. And especially the ships, they're just special. They're really special. Love it. So yeah. Let's talk about the ship that's coming up.
Yeah, man.
What's the plan?
So, well, we're going from Miami on January 6th to Belize.
Oh, wow.
So, and it's 5 nights, which is like the longest we've ever done, yeah. But it has to be 5 because it takes 2 to get to Belize.
Yeah.
But the reason why it's going to be the best one is when I went on that cruise in 97, we went to this island and they let us stay on the island all night. And I just remember laying there, like looking at the stars and like hearing the music. And I was like, this is insane.
Yeah.
And so every time we've done a cruise to this point, any island that we go to, you have to leave before it gets dark.
Yeah.
Always. Right. Because there's a tender, there's a, you know, you could fall into the water. Like you got to get out of there. So the party's like 10 a.m. You know, I'm like waking everybody up, get to the beach. Everyone's still up, you know, sleep from last night. And then by 3-4 in the afternoon, you got to get on the ship and leave.
Yeah.
So the island in Belize that we have, Harvest Key, I already went there. It's got lights and it's got a dock.
Amazing.
So we pull in at like 9 a.m. and then we get to stay till 9 a.m. the next morning.
Oh, wow.
So we get the sunset and the sunrise. And then on the island, I have like, you know, I think the lineup, it's like Todd Edwards, Justin Martin, Bob Moses, Boys Noise, Chris Lake, Skrill, and then the Sermon.
Yeah.
All like in a row. And wow. So the whole ship gets off. The island holds like 4,000 people. And then we get to go till the sun comes up on the island. And then we get back on. And then I have everything turned off till about 3 p.m. to let everybody sleep and kind of regroup.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's the game changer. That's what I've always wanted. That's the last thing that I haven't been able to recreate was the 24 hours on the island.
Yeah. Can people go back and forth on the ship?
Yeah. So the island has a dock.
Yeah.
Right. So the ship parks there.
Oh, wow.
And that's your hotel. So you could just go, like, you can go eat, take a shower on the ship, come back. But the island has places to eat and everything as well. But it's just us on that island. And it's going to be sick. Plus, the ship itself, it's called the Joy. And it has like a go-kart track on the top. Jesus. It's got water slides. It's got like 21 restaurants. And I mean, it's definitely by far the biggest ship that we've ever done.
How many people does that hold?
The stat that I like to give people, guess how much the staff is.
Million?
Not my staff. This is just the staff from the ship side. They have 1,700 people staff. So
how much does that cost?
The staff or the ship?
The staff.
Well, it comes with the ship.
Okay. How much does the ship cost?
You don't want to know. it's too much.
So how many people can come on?
Well, it depends on how you configure the rooms, because I can make each room a single, a double, a triple, or a quad.
Yeah.
But they base it on double occupancy.
Okay.
Right. So if you have 2 people in every room, it's about close to 4,000 people.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. So it could get up to like 4,800 people, I think is probably where they max out, because they have a certain amount of lifeboats for everybody. And then you can't configure more than that.
Yeah.
So we're about 90% sold out.
Amazing, man. So I know the goal is to sell out, but on a financial situation, what is your break even?
We're around there now. Yeah. Like I'll be all right. I'll be able to make another one. I'll be able to do another one, but I'd like to get that last 10%. Yeah. That would help me.
So you're not stressing too much.
I mean, I'm always stressing, you know, and you know, you got 4,000 people on a fucking ship in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah. That's a lot.
It's a lot.
Do you take a family on there still?
My wife always comes, but yeah, this time I'm trying to take my son and my daughter.
Amazing.
You know, really, because you know they only saw me like when they were little.
Of course,
they haven't really seen, you know, they haven't really seen what I'm up to since they've been like teenagers and kind of like my daughter's friends now go to Heart.
Yeah,
she's like, Dad, some of my friends had a Heart after party, and you know,
how so do you feel about that?
That her friends go there, or that it's like that, my old thing,
and that it's like no, that her friends go there, and it's gonna be about time that she will probably end up going there.
I think it's cool. I'm glad they like house music. You know, yeah. When she turned 16, which was like almost like a year and a half ago, we had a sweet 16, and so I asked her like 10 times about the music, and you know, she didn't really, you know, tell me what was going on. Then like last minute, she's like, oh, we got a DJ. Can you get the equipment? And I was like, I was just going to use the Sono. So I'm like, you know, this was at a friend's house. So I don't have a PA or any of that shit. So I was like, well, what does the DJ use? So she put me in touch with the DJ guy. And I guess he just plays off his phone. But I was like, okay, this is Destructo's daughter's sweet 16. Like, I got to have a bumping system. I can't like just let him play on the Sonos. So last minute I got all the shit. And then I went there and I was like, you know, I thought they would just play all hip hop.
Yeah.
And they played MIA. Sick. They played like the Crookers, Kid Cudi. They played like Robin S. They played a lot of house and dance.
Amazing.
And I was like, oh, wow, this is cool. Like her friends like dance music. And then she told me like her friends like Waxy. Dad, like I've been listening to Wax Motif, and you know, it's cool to see that. It made me realize like, you know, house music ain't going nowhere ever. No, like we're in there like rock, like R&B.
Yeah.
You know, we're staple now. It's not like maybe it'll come and go. Like they love it, and they, you know, they all want to be DJs, dude. Yeah. Every, you know, she says every dude in her high school is a DJ.
I love that though. I love that to a certain extent. Yeah. There is space for everybody. Although there does come a point when it's like, well, hang on, you can't all be DJs because there's not going to be enough shows for you all to work at. But
well, there's more DJs. I feel like there's more DJs than there are people that want to go see DJs.
Definitely, definitely. It's kind of interesting though, because it's the barrier of entry to become a DJ is so low now, which is great, but it just doesn't mean that you're going to get, I don't know if it means you're going to get as many DJs that actually are performing on a regular basis, but there's going to be a bunch of home DJs that are playing at house parties for their mates, which is fucking great. That's the culture, realistically. That's how the culture rebuilds, because there's a bunch of kids playing house parties and like playing music to, they're the curators, they're the Pete Tongs and everything like that to their friends, and it's just a way smaller community. It's pretty interesting.
Well, my hope would be that they're just doing it because they enjoy it and it's fun.
Yeah.
You know, my problem with it is like when I meet these people that like, you know, I'm trying to build my brand, I'm getting more likes. I'm, you know, if you're just like turning up to your friend mate's house at 10 o'clock at night and you're just playing tunes and you guys are all bugging out and having fun, like that's what it's about, right? Yeah. That's what we did.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't fault anyone for that. That's awesome. But like, it just irks me sometimes when like their goal is to like make money, you know, their goal is to like make it their like career or like their, you know, I've had so many people tell them, I'm trying to build my brand.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like when Kool-Aid came in my house and said, we're going to do Electric Daisy Carnival, we weren't trying to build a brand.
No.
Like, it just seemed cool.
Yeah.
Fuck, we're going to have a fire eater and a bearded lady and a guest your weight booth. That's dope. Like, it wasn't like, man, maybe we can make money and get followers. You know, it was like, we just wanted to like have someone guess our weight.
Yeah.
And party, you know, and look what it turned into, you know? So I think the motive behind it is important.
Right, I think
why you're doing it.
Yeah, I think social media has changed that, and I don't know if we're going back. I don't know if
we're definitely not going back. No. But I hope there's some people that like, you know, come through with like I mean, not hope. There will be. There's going to be like new versions of people that come through with new ideas that will stick. It's just harder to get through. It's harder to get to the top. But I gotta believe it'll happen, right? Like eventually. This shift will change and people will get sick of this shit and something new will kick through and you'll be like, whoa, what the fuck was that? You know?
Yeah, it will. It will definitely, man. It will. So how can people buy tickets? How can people get involved with the Friendship Vibe?
So you just go to, I think it's the Friendship, it's the friendship.com.
I love that you don't even know yourself. Let me get this up.
It's the friendship.com or just follow me.
Yeah.
Yeah, friendship.com. I know on Twitter it's at, it's just Friendship. We got lucky. We got that.
Yeah. We'll, I'll make sure I'll make sure the links are in the description. So anybody's listening, go put the go click on the link in the description.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be cool. It'd be cool to grab a few more like newbies into the family. You know, that's how my head's thinking like right now, like this last 10%, like basically all the people who know me, know Friendship, know my deal, they're in.
Yeah.
It's how do I get to the new 10%, like, you know, 25-year-olds.
That will then carry on talking about it afterwards. Yeah. It's
and from like different countries, you know, like my little secret was on Holy Ship in 2012, I bought Facebook ads.
Yeah.
I bought, and I spent like $100, like in London, $100 in Paris, $100 in Seoul, $100 in like Rio de Janeiro, you know, all these, you know, Dallas,
you know,
but what happened was I got like one or two people from each one of those places. And it made this like smattering of like people that were like, huh, I'll go see that on a ship. And like, they just took a chance.
Yeah. I know somebody from the UK that goes, they used to go every year. And
yeah,
he was an older guy as well. He was, and he would go every single year.
Yeah, it's cool. It's cool to see the difference, like people from different countries and different vibes coming together. You know, that because to me, I mean, I always say, right, the people make the party.
Yeah, 100%.
So you need like a cool, you know, and I think, you know, the other thing about the family we were talking about, I think part of that does come for me because my ethos with dance music is like, everybody's fucking welcome. Like you can, you know, when I'm at one of my shows and I see somebody like in a wheelchair, like the first thing I do, I go over to them.
Yeah.
And I fucking high five them. Can I get you a drink?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like to me, it's not about like the most beautiful person. It's just, if you're in it, like if you're like the worst dancer in the world, but you're like in it, high five, man. Like you're letting loose. And like, that's always been my ethos of like, the party, right? Like just if people are just in the party, it doesn't matter like your status or where, like you, if you're fucking Skrillex or you're like a homeless person, like if you're there and you're having fun and you're in it and you're like being cool, like that's the vibe.
Yeah.
And I think that trickled down into everybody else. Everybody, like there's no one's being judged on that ship. You know, everyone's just doing, hey, you're a fucking weirdo, come on in.
Yeah. And my advice to any artist that's listening, that's going on Holy Ship as a DJ, go and do crowd work, go and get involved in everything, go and be part of the crowd. Don't just fucking sit in a room the whole time, go and enjoy it. And I promise you, it will benefit your career. Promise you.
Friendship.
Promise you. Go do it, people. Gary, I've loved this conversation, mate. Thank you so much for coming on. I really, really do appreciate it. And let's catch up when I'm in LA next.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me, dude. Keep it rolling. I was, you know, I don't do a lot of these interviews and things anymore, but you know, I was looking forward to talking to you because I know you keep it real.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
We'll keep brainstorming on how to,
we'll get there, man. We'll get there one day.
How to seismic shift the electronic music scene again.
If I got any ideas, I'll send them over to you for sure. Awesome. Also, thanks for all the support over the years, man. It means a lot. Really, it really does. Really appreciate it. So keep in touch.
Keep making those bangers.
I try, man. Keep safe, mate. Take care. Thank you.
Later.
Peace. And that's a wrap. Big love to Destructive for coming on. If you enjoyed that, please share. Please subscribe. Get involved in the Discord channel, and I will catch you very soon. Big love.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you're ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.